Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 4.
Still working with Aristotle's reasoning, Thomas advances the next step in his argument.
If that by which something is moved be itself moved, then this moved mover also must needs be moved by another, and that by another again.
In mapping out this sequence of movers, Thomas explores Aristotle's concept of motion as change from potentiality to actuality. Not all philosophers will agree with Aristotle and Thomas that change is best analyzed using the concepts of actuality and potentiality. But there's a second point that's even more controversial. In his imaginary conversation with Aristotle, Thomas says,
"But this series of moved movers cannot go on to infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently no other mover, and therefore no motion, seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are moved by the first mover."
Then Thomas adds briefly,
"As the staff moves only because it is moved by the hand."
That is so cryptic that it seems more like code than a helpful illustration, but it's clear to Thomas's students. In the Summa, Thomas tells us that he is addressing beginners in theology. We need to remember that these beginners have already completed their studies in philosophy. He can count on them to have enough background to decode his reference. Indeed, he's probably taken many of the students at the Dominican House of Studies through Aristotle's proofs in the physics and the metaphysics. But if we're to appreciate the force of Thomas's argument, we need to remind ourselves of what was already familiar to his students. This concerns whether it's possible or impossible to have an infinite series. Taken at face value, an infinite series of movers seems quite possible. We might wonder if Thomas would so confidently declare that an infinite series is impossible if he'd known that the universe in its present state is several billion years old and may have proceeded from an even older state or series of states. Well, it so happens that we do know how he'd reply. One of the controversial issues among the learned of his day was whether it could be proved that the universe began at some definite moment of time, or whether instead it had always existed. Teachers in the Faculty of Arts at Paris practically identified philosophy with Aristotle. They were convinced that he had demonstrated the world to be eternal. But some theologians insisted that the very thought of an eternal world was contradiction. In this dispute about an infinite series, Thomas disagrees with the philosophers, but he's even more put out by the overzealous and indiscriminate attacks of some theologians. In a rare departure from his usual serenity, he grumbles that these theologians who think that an eternal world is a contradiction talk as though wisdom begins with their hawk-like vision.
Another surprising thing is that the best philosophers of nature failed to discern this alleged contradiction. The same situation emerges if we carefully consider the position of those who held that the world has always existed. For in spite of this, they teach that it was made by God, and perceived no logical inconsistency in this doctrine. Therefore, these theologians who do decry such alleged inconsistency with their hawk-like vision are the only rational beings, and wisdom was born with them.
Thomas earns no thanks from either group for his subtle position. As a Christian, he's willing to believe that time itself is created in the same act by which the eternal God continually creates the universe. Nevertheless, Thomas also holds there is no reason why God himself must precede his own creation in time. And so there's nothing inconceivable about the notion of an eternal universe. Philosophically speaking, the universe could be without a beginning. On the face of it, Thomas seems to contradict himself. He holds on the one hand that there cannot be an infinite series, and declares on the other hand that there can be such a series. But we're usually too hasty when we charge a trained mind with such an obvious contradiction. When Thomas insists that the series of movers cannot be infinite, he has in mind a second kind of series, a series quite different from a series that has no beginning. Still talking with Aristotle in the Summa Theologiae, Thomas draws a distinction between two senses of beginning. Then, on the basis of two beginnings, he distinguishes two kinds of series.
there are two kinds of causes. One kind is essential, the other, accidental. An essential cause of something is that which directly causes it through the cause's own power, as water is the cause of cooling. But an accidental cause of something is that which causes it indirectly, for example, by removing an opposing cause, as when it cools a house by putting out a fire.
In one sense, to begin is to start. Here a beginning is part of the movement which follows. A beginning is that movement's initial moment. But in another sense, to begin is to originate. Such a beginning is not merely a starting point, but is rather the very source and origin of the whole movement. As we'll see, a beginning in time is distinguished from a beginning cause. Modern cosmology theorizes that there was a condensed cloud point at the very beginning of our present universe. A cloud point existing even before the supposed Big Bang. But we can still entertain the suspicion that there was a previous state, a state before the emergence of our current universe. And before that, is still another, and perhaps another, to infinity. But Thomas says that whether or not the time series has a start, there's a second kind of series, a series of causes or movers. This series makes its presence felt in time, but it's not itself essentially temporal. It's not successive or diachronic, but simultaneous or synchronic. We recognize something similar when we recognize that some necessary and sufficient conditions must exist to enable a particular event to occur. Modern holograms, three-dimensional images in which every part contains the features of the whole, reawaken our sense that many dynamic factors often coexist simultaneously in a complex whole. Ecological studies also remind us that natural events have complex and simultaneous causes. Nevertheless, our long-standing modern impulse is to break complex units down into the simplest elements and then arrange them in a time sequence. They seem only then to be more precise, more certain, neater. We're still prone today to speak of causation in terms of a temporal series of events. We tend to think of a cause as a preceding condition. Sequential causality has been aptly called two-event causation. Event A, say a billiard ball struck by a pool cue, occurs at time one. Event B follows at time two. The ball thuds against the table cushion. If we dare to say that A at time one causes B at time two, we have seen two-event causation. But Thomas speaks about another series that may be called one-event causation. A modern Thomist explains the notion this way.
Causing and being caused are not, therefore, two events, one taking place in the agent and the other in the patient. They constitute a single ontological event. It follows necessarily, and obviously, that it is impossible for them to be anything else than simultaneous.
An event may take place in one instant or over a series of moments, but the relevant series of causes operates simultaneously. Joint causation is necessary, as with a conductor in a symphony orchestra. Thomas's second series of causes simultaneously originates some event or result. Thomas calls this second series the series of essential causes or movers, a per se series. Others have called it a vertical series to distinguish it from the horizontal time series. Whereas a time series need not have a first event, the per se series must have a first cause. There must be a source of motion, or there would be no motion in the first place. A first and ultimate source must move the other movers without itself being moved by another. This is the unmoved mover. The conclusion draws itself.
Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover, moved by no other.
But then Thomas adds, with a flourish,
and this everyone understands to be God.
There is no denying that this flourish is also a leap. Thomas leaps from what looks very much like the unmoved mover to what looks very much like the biblical God. This is the conclusion of Thomas's first way of proving God's existence. Each of his remaining four ways of proving God's existence ends with the same flourish. So, in the first way, we've seen that the unmoved mover is God. In the second way, the uncaused cause is God. In Thomas's third way, the necessary being is God. And in the fourth way, the perfect goodness is God. Finally, in Thomas's fifth and most popular way, the guiding intelligence is God. A modern interpreter has said that Thomas frees God from the categories of motion, causality, necessity, goodness, and governance, since in themselves these names are too restrictive. This interpreter says that only the category of being can be broad enough for God.
How does this get God out of the categories? If such a being were in a category, that category would have to be the category of being. Now, no act of existing can be a category.
In moving beyond these categories, Thomas moves beyond his philosophical sources, but he remains in the line of philosophy. We need to think a bit more about what Thomas has proven, if indeed he's proven anything. At issue in these five ways is not how a specific quality gets transmitted from one thing to another, rather the issue is how that quality exists at all. Thomas clearly says in the Summa that the movement he speaks about is not simply a movement from one place to another, nor an increase in size or weight, nor a change of color or shape. He speaks of movement in the most fundamental terms, so all these specific movements are, at bottom, the primal movement of coming to be. So Thomas's first way doesn't concern the transmission of motion from one thing to another. Modern physics can tell us much more about that. Rather, the first way of proving God's existence addresses why motion exists at all. What is at stake is the very existence of motion. Of course, we can ignore or neglect the original cause of motion. Indeed, we mostly do ignore it in order to get on with the demands of everyday life. Someone who always wonders about the origin of things is usually dubbed by practical people to be a poet, maybe somewhat odd, or at least impractical. For Thomas, however, philosophy consists in consolidating that wonder, in entertaining it, in exploring it methodically, and in following wherever it leads. We can suppress the question that asks why the causes of motion exist, but if left alone, our questioning impulse leads us to seek an explanation for all indispensable aspects of the observed motion. To communicate the fact of existence is the prerogative of a being that does not come from others. This being exists by right. Such a being simply is. It is pure being. The absolute first being in the order of movers is itself ungenerated being. It does not come to be. The first mover communicates to others the being without which nothing at all would exist. In Thomas's words,
as long as the cause remains, the effect remains. If the cause is removed, the effect is removed too.
If this first mover didn't exist, there would be no movement. Since we began by observing that there is movement, then there must be such a being. The essential nature of an original cause is that it must be, through and through, pure, self-subsistent being. In the language of actuality and potentiality, the original cause is the pure actuality of existence. It needs no other being in order to exist, nor does it need to be explained or justified. On the contrary, the existence of everything else is explained and accounted for by the first cause. Thomas's four other ways of proving God's existence help us to see the richness of this pure being. Such a mover, itself unmoved, and such a cause, itself uncaused, is absolute and necessary being. It is all the attributes that belong to pure being. It is all that is good and highest, intelligent and purposeful. In a word, it is divine.
And it is this that everyone understands to be God.
Thomas has no doubt that human reason here catches a glimpse of the same God recorded in the Bible. Thomas believes God has revealed himself to Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike, and in his own way, to all mankind. But words can only do so much. It's time to reflect on the proof and to bring it to the test of our own experience.
This is the end of part 4. Please download part 5 to continue.